Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Jammo Thomas, I Spy for the FBI on Thomas Records. No relation to Jammo, amazingly. 1966, of course, it didn't chart. And he has a Chicago connection. Came back to Chicago in the mid-60s to be Jerry Butler's valet. And wound up in almost moments on Thomas Records with that, which, by the way, is a cover. Yeah, I know. A non-hit cover of a non-hit. Originally, Luther Ingram did that. Hard to believe, but true. I'm Raleigh James. It is WGN Radio. And you can give us a call as the mood might strike you, and hopefully we'll give you plenty of reason. 888-876-5593. That's 8888-ROLLYE. When I got stalling for time, which is several weeks ago now, I waited a couple days because I was reading something else. Then I picked it up, and it was one of those nonstop reads, and I just loved it. So, Gary Nestner, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Raleigh. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight, and I enjoyed hearing that song. I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, right. That's Jammo Thomas, the more well-known version of that, but I'll be happy to email you a copy if you send me your email address. So,
yeah, that'd be great. I haven't heard it before, yeah.
Excellent. Now, in the first chapter of your book is the compelling story about Charlie, and how you had to lie to him to save the lives of the hostages, his common-law wife and young son. Now, I had no problem with that, by the way, and the rationale behind it, and I know you didn't either. It's one of those things. But the question that came to mind for me is, anybody reading this or knowing these stories who happens to have their own hostage-taking tendencies, why should they ever believe anything a negotiator tells them?
Well, I think that's the point, and the interesting part of that story is it's just such a rare thing. I think even today it may be the only case in the FBI where a negotiator recommended a sort of a tactical resolution. We know that lying comes back to bite us, and we try to avoid that at almost all costs. It has to be simply, you know, a matter of life or death before we would engage in that sort of trickery. I mean, what we've learned through the years of doing this is that what resolves tense incidences, building a relationship of trust and demonstrating genuineness and sincerity and, you know, an honest attempt to try to help this person get out of a difficult situation. So when we're forced into engaging in some manipulative practices, it's not something we cherish or we are as our first option by far. But I thought the case was an important one to lay out, and sort of the case that sold the book to Random House.
I'm not surprised. And again, not questioning your tactics or the reason behind them, and that's never a decision that's made lightly, clearly. And you emphasize that in the telling of the story. This is one of those last resort situations. But where my question comes is that hostage takers are their own breed, obviously, and they're distrusting by nature. So they tend to not want to believe anything you're saying anyway. So how does a negotiator, especially in light of knowing stories like Charlie's, gain the confidence of the terrorist?
Well, hostage taking is a very specific activity. It's holding a hostage against their will and threatening to harm them to try to force somebody else to do something. Freeing someone from prison, you know, changing foreign policy if it's a terrorist situation, getting money, whatever it might be. It's a very instrumental activity. And when someone takes a hostage, they feel empowered. We can make the authorities do what we want simply by threatening to harm this hostage. And when we as negotiators slow the process down and we make them work very hard for everything they get, they slowly come to the understanding that they don't have as much power and control as they initially thought, and they can't just get us simply to jump because they say jump. And ultimately, they're left with a simple decision, either cooperate with law enforcement or run the risk of being injured or perhaps even killed. So fortunately for us, people who take hostages are there to get something, a demand met. They're not there to die. So we're very successful in those. That's really only about 10%. About 90% of what we do are very emotionally charged situations where there is no clear goal. The perpetrator is merely expressing rage, frustration, anger, sense of hurt, whatever it might be, and those can end quite deadly.
Oh yes, they absolutely. Now you talk about the mindset of the hostage taker. My favorite story in the book about that is the hijacker who gave up when he realized he couldn't get a decent cup of coffee, and that to me was almost downright humorous. But it sort of underscored my belief that I don't know of any instance where these kind of events work out well for the perpetrators. I think possibly the only example to the contrary might be D.B. Cooper, whatever became of him. But other than that, I can't think of anybody who has held a hostage or has hijacked a plane or anything of this nature where it ended well for them.
Well, there are a few examples, and mostly back in the 70s and perhaps very early 80s, where over in the Middle East, where some countries, unequipped to really manage these things properly, believed that the best way to resolve them was to, you know, make the concessions that were demanded and let the hijackers fly off and let the hostages go. And that happened in several infamous situations and really led to the passing in 1984 of a law that made it an international crime to hold Americans hostage, and that brought the FBI into the international arena of any time an American was held, we would investigate the case and do our best to bring to justice the perpetrators. Because there, sadly, had been several examples where perpetrators simply got away.
It's interesting because, of course, focusing on the United States, I'm not sure, like I say, other than perhaps D.B. Cooper, that I know of any. It all seems to end from bad to much worse and everything in between. And I wonder about the mentality of somebody, you know, in the United States, because we do see this here, and we're going to see more terrorism. In fact, I do want to get into the ending of your book and what you talked about. But with regard to that, what's the mindset, and is there any commonality in mindset of people who go to these extremes that they think they'll get away with it?
Well, you know, when I was a very young FBI agent in the 70s, here domestically in the United States, there was a fair number of kidnaps for ransom, which is a hostage taking.
Right.
And the FBI became extraordinarily good at catching the bad guys. I mean, we developed very sophisticated surveillance techniques and so forth, where we exploited the vulnerability of the kidnappers, which is somewhere they have to pick up the money. And before long, that crime became, to what it is today in the United States, a very rare crime, because you know, smart criminals say, hey, I'm going to do something that I can get away with, because kidnapping is just not typically going to work out for me. So we really did quite an effective job of cutting that crime back. Overseas, in a lot of the developing world where there is, you know, inefficient law enforcement, a corrupt judicial system, so forth and so on, the crime remains pretty strong. Mexico, Colombia, and some other South American and Middle East countries. But by and large, we've eliminated it here, and that's kind of the answer to it, you know, is to really relentlessly pursue these guys and make sure they don't benefit from the rewards of this activity.
And you've done a heck of a job. Like I say, in recent times, I can't think of any successful kidnapping that's been pulled off where we all wondered or anything. It almost always tends to end badly, which is good news. And a lot of that has to do with negotiating abilities as well as many of the other techniques. But I was surprised to learn that negotiating is actually relatively new to the FBI.
Well, it started in the mid '70s by NYPD as a method to try to make to achieve better outcomes, because they had a couple infamous cases, Dog Day Afternoon, and some others that didn't turn out so well. And they came up with the concept, and it was a great concept. The FBI, as we do when we hear a good idea, we steal it and refine it and expand it and begin to teach it around the United States and around the globe. And it's up to this point, the level of the sophistication that's involved in training negotiators and using their skills has literally saved thousands and thousands of lives. There's no clear statistics on it, but it's probably one of the most successful things that has evolved in law enforcement. And, you know, it's in keeping with our philosophy, certainly in the FBI and beyond, that we use no more force than is absolutely necessary. If we can resolve a situation peacefully, it more likely leads to a safe release for the hostages. It allows for the perpetrator to survive, and it keeps our people from going into a dangerous situation and possibly being harmed. So on several levels, it's a win-win-win.
It is, and it should be a no-brainer. But what I also picked up with some of your book, especially Waco, but in other places as well, it's not an open and shut issue within the FBI. It still seems like there are individuals who think that this is just a waste of everyone's time.
Well, that certainly was the case pre-Waco. We had some, which was 93, we had some individuals that still sort of clung to that, you know, entrenched law enforcement. Hey, we're the good guys, we're tough, we don't have to put up with any nonsense, you're a bad guy, do what we say, we're going to come in and get you. That had eroded pretty much. And the issue with Waco, really, if somebody really wants to dig into it, it's not so much that the FBI didn't know what to do, it's that we departed from what we had been doing successfully for quite some time. Before Waco, the FBI had handled several right-wing militia standoffs, prison riots, terrorist events, and had been phenomenally successful. And yet somehow, because of some personality issues, we had leadership that really didn't pay attention to those lessons and went in different directions. And it certainly contributed to the tragic outcome. I mean, ultimately, David Koresh was responsible, but it didn't mean the FBI performed at its best.
Oh, boy, howdy. And we're gonna talk about that and a number of other things. If you've got any questions, I'd love for you to join us. Gary Nestner is my guest. The book is Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. I think it's a great read, and I've got a link at Rolly.net if you want to pick up a copy from Amazon, and that's Rolly.net. And, of course, 888-876-5593 is 8888-ROLLYE, the easiest way for you to get to me tonight right here on WGN Radio.
They're brave and bold, but look at them, you wouldn't think they'd catch a cold. But when Hemlock Holmes is leading them, there's just no doubt. For criminals, it's Roger Dodger over and out. Dick Tracy,
he's got a bulldog jaw.
Yeah, I couldn't avoid that one either, really. That's Dick Tracy by The Chance, 1961 on Verve. No, of course it didn't chart. That was Pete Antel's group, who also recorded as the Tremonts. They didn't chart either. He did a lot of stuff, mostly under the radar, but some stuff was revolutionary, like arguably the first surf guitar tune, Stampede, in 1959, but that was Dick Tracy. And we are talking to Gary Nestner, Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. And it is just a great book, also an inspiration for Waco, the TV event on Paramount, and probably a lot more. And I'm still somewhat stunned that the history that we're talking about goes back really to the 70s, and you were saying that since Waco, it's more accepted with regard to the FBI. I had to wonder about Waco, by the way. Was the April 19th date you know, the Battle of Lexington and Concord, the Norman invasion. Was that selected or did that just happen?
Well, I was already gone from the scene then, but I think it just happened. It was not purposefully selected. The day before, they sort of got affirmation from Koresh's assistant that, despite what he had indicated, he had not really begun to write the seven seals that were to be completed before they would surrender, and I think they decided to go on in. But, yeah, it's, negotiations, as I mentioned, was accepted and embraced in the FBI, but we have long had sort of a yin and yang within law enforcement. There's always law enforcement is a paramilitary entity in federal, state, local, and there's always been a push and a pull against those who want to do things a certain way and those who want to exercise the use of force. But for me, particularly in these times where law enforcement actions are being so closely scrutinized, it's really critical that whatever we do withstands the scrutiny of not only a court of law, but a court of public opinion. Did we show restraint? Did we make every reasonable effort to resolve a situation peacefully? And did we, or when we resorted to the use of force, was it with ample justification? I mean, could a case be made that we had no choice but to attempt to try to save someone's life? And those are the criteria, I think, that we have to meet before we engage in something more difficult. You know, three years after Waco, we had a 85-day siege in Montana with the Freemen, a right-wing militia group. Right. And this time, the negotiators were, my team was in charge of setting the strategy, and the new director, Louis Fries, fully supported it. And, you know, it took 85 days, but no shots were fired. Everybody came out, peaceful ending. And it fell off the radar screen in the news media because nobody died, no fire. And that was the way we had done things before Waco, and it has become the way we've done things after and since. So Waco was really a very unique situation in so many ways, but it was really a departure from the norm.
Were you involved in that from the beginning of the FBI's involvement?
Of the negotiation program?
Well, of the basically targeting Waco, and targeting is probably the wrong word, but at the point it became on the FBI's radar that we might have a problem in Texas. Were you in on it that early?
No. The FBI had been, as I recall, there had been some Australian, there were Branch Davidians who had come from several countries, and some of them were Australian and had raised a complaint to their government that there was abuse ongoing. Their government informed the U.S. government, which brought the FBI in to make a preliminary inquiry, which it did, and there was no, the investigation was closed without further action. I wasn't involved in that. That happened at a local level. But obviously, the day of the shootout between the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and the Davidians, now that federal agents had been killed, that's what triggered the FBI coming into it to resolve it.
The entire siege surprised me only because, and I was actually in Austin for a few years around this time, David Koresh was sort of well-known in Waco. He left the compound somewhat regularly. The sheriff liked him a lot, and there were other people who interacted with him all the time. And the Australian you're talking about, Mark, I think was his name, he was just hell-bent on making an issue over many points for better or worse, truth or not. And what I always wondered was that, especially when, you know, the child abuse charges began to be raised, which I think was the first one that maybe opened some federal eyes to, hey, maybe we need to look at this. But when that happened, I would have thought they easily could have gotten David Koresh because he left the compound fairly regularly early on. Why didn't they just arrest him when he was away from there?
Well, I think the investigations that were conducted after Waco pretty much agree with you on that point, that the preferred method would have been to arrest the leader away. And in fact, 3 years later in the Montana incident, this time with the FBI initiating it, we did just that. We arrested the leaders away from the others. And while that did not immediately resolve it, it certainly changed the entire complexion of it. So, yeah, I think, there's a lot of speculation that ATF was an agency on the chopping block federally. They had a lot of enemies in Congress, and that they were hoping to get a pretty dramatic incident that would showcase their contributions to federal law enforcement. And that probably convinced some of the commanders to go forward when they should have canceled the mission after it became known that the element of surprise had been lost.
The other thing I wondered about was, clearly it turned out that there was no doubt that David Koresh was engaging in statutory rape, and in some cases with preteen girls. These were very young girls, and he had a harem of underage children, really, for lack of a better term. But beyond that, the idea that he was abusing them, and I know it's hard to say, you know, like, other than that, Mrs. Kennedy, how'd you like Dallas? But beyond that, how, you know, there weren't any substantiated cases of other forms of abuse or many of the other charges that were leveled at him. I mean, I know they tried to get him on gun violations, and that didn't turn out. So in the aftermath, other than what we knew going in, that he was a serial statutory rapist, was there anything else that would have stuck had he lived?
Well, obviously, the shootout with the ATF agents and killing four agents and wounding 17 would have been the prevailing charge.
I mean, pre-search.
ATF, to my knowledge, their initial investigative interest was not focused on the child abuse at all. It was on the illegal modification of weapons, turning them from semi-automatic into fully automatic. And, you know, reports came in. There was, I think, a UPS driver that a box mm-hmm. fell and some grenade fell on the ground. There was sounds of shooting at night at a firing range. There was a number of factors that came into play that brought about the investigation. So I wouldn't criticize them on that. You can, I think, fairly criticize them on how the operation unfolded. But I think examining, they were doing their job. You know, there was a violation of firearms laws, and they were duly investigating it.
Was there? And see, that's something I was never clear on. I know they were investigating it. I know they had some undercover people infiltrate the compound and stuff, but I had not heard that they actually got them on an actual violation. I know a lot of allegations, but...
Well, they didn't get them. I mean, there was a search warrant and an arrest warrant for David Koresh, and obviously those never got fulfilled, you know, because of the firefight that ensued. So what they would have been able to successfully prosecute him on had the arrest been successful and the search conducted, I mean, I don't know. I mean, again, that wasn't part of the FBI's activity, or, you know, I wasn't involved in that whatsoever. That's ATF.
Right. And of course, I think to most people, the shock was the public stance that Janet Reno took versus how it turned out. And I think probably more than any other personality, her reputation hung on that event. But a year before Waco was the Boundary County situation I live near there in Idaho. Actually, I guess I live near a terrorist.
Yep.
I don't know. But Randy Weaver. And there again, I don't know. I don't think you were involved in that situation like you were in the Freeman, which turned out very well. And congratulations to you on that, by the way. But with regard to Randy Weaver, it seemed like a textbook case of what not to do.
Yeah, again, with Randy Weaver, he was investigated by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They tried to turn him as an informant against right-wing militia groups. He refused, so they charged him and had an arrest warrant, and subsequently U.S. Marshals went out there to arrest him, and that's what triggered the firefight between the Weaver family and the Marshals. A Marshal was killed, Weaver's son was killed, Weaver and a friend were wounded, and then they, as in Waco, because federal agents had been killed, the FBI came in. I was out of the country at the time, and my partner was there, but there was an immediate deployment of FBI personnel up to the mountaintop, and an order was given to shoot armed individuals. And, you know, the investigation found that order was illegal. In law enforcement, you can only use deadly force if your life or someone else is threatened. You can't merely shoot someone because they have a weapon in their hand unless it's directed at you. But that's what happened. And unfortunately, that scandal, as it were, had not fully emerged in terms of the light of day and judicial scrutiny until Waco had already started. So the same tactical commander who was in charge of Ruby Ridge was still in charge of the hostage rescue team at Waco. six months later.
Whoa.
Yeah. I think that's certainly an area where I think criticism is, should be considered there, because it's just, organizations aren't really good at disciplining their own, and the FBI is no different. It's a proud organization, but we're human beings and people make mistakes. But, I'm very proud of having been in the FBI, and agents are very hardworking, dedicated, professional. But to say that mistakes aren't made and haven't been made, then some of them have tragic consequences, it's clearly the truth.
Yeah, and you bring a lot of that up in your book as well, and I could palpably feel the frustration at some of the events in Waco while you were there, in terms of how you thought it should be handled. And as you mentioned, since then things have changed. The Freeman siege went off textbook good. But from that point forward, and of course this extends to all the period of time after you were out of the FBI, how do you think it is today?
Well, I don't know. Part of the reason I wrote my book, now it's been out 10 years, was hoping that today's FBI leaders would learn these lessons, because it's been quite some time since the FBI's handled some of the big events that we had back when I was aboard. And, if people don't have that experience, they can tend to make the same mistakes if they don't learn the lessons about what was done right and what was done wrong. What Waco really illustrates is that when you have situations like that, emotions are very high. And when emotions are high, rational thinking behavior are quite low. So the hallmark negotiation team is self-control and being patient and genuine and sincere and creating a relationship of trust. And slowly through that process, we lower the emotional engagement and we help people come to a point where they can think and behave more rationally. It's scientific, it's anecdotal, it clearly does work. And we couple that with what we call the paradox of power. And that is, the harder you push, the more likely you are to be met with resistance. And that's a lesson that law enforcement, I think, has to be reminded of, that when we go to someone's dwelling and we are posturing in a way that they view as threatening, whether we do that intentionally or not, their first inclination is often to resist. And we have to take actions and maneuver ourselves in a way that doesn't raise the level of confrontation, that in fact it tends to lower it. And that's the point at which we are so phenomenally successful at getting people to cooperate. They expect a very authoritative, commanding law enforcement response, and instead they get a negotiator saying, hey, my name's Gary, I'm here to help you. let's work together and resolve this. And it sounds pretty simple, and in many regards it is, but it's absolutely, it works tremendously. People want to be listened to, they want to be understood, they want to be respected. Well, there's no secret there, so that's the way you handle it.
And of course, by the time you get in there as a negotiator, things have already gone pretty wrong for the perpetrator. They already have a level of frustration from it not being the textbook method that they thought. So I would assume that also gives them more desire to reach out to a friendly voice saying, I'm here to help. Gary Noesner is our guest. The book is Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. And as I was saying, at the end of the book, one of the things that Gary brings up, and again, this is a decade ago, so it's prophetic at this point, is that the nation should be better prepared for a terrorist event. Are we? I'm Raleigh James, 888-876-5593, 888-88-ROLLYE, and this is WGN Radio.
Back to me, kidnapper. You got me in misery.
Jewel and the Rubies, Kidnapper, 1963 on La Louisiane. That's a beach music anthem, so if you're into Carolina beach music, Jewel actually was a Louisiana teacher. Kidnapper was actually the reworking of an earlier song put out by Duke on Duke label in Houston. Yeah, Don Robey's label. Yeah, I say reworking, that's being generous. But nonetheless, a nice record. And Gary Nesser is our guest. Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. And as I was saying, at the end of the book, Gary brings up that nations should be better prepared for a terrorist event. So now it's a decade later. Are we?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think we are in some regards, and others perhaps not. You know, a great deal of terrorism evokes strong emotions, understandably, and a lot of money is thrown at various agencies under the umbrella of terrorism preparation and response. And we have command posts and communication centers and all sorts of coordinating elements that are supposed to make the government respond better to terrorism. But I continue to question whether or not we really have a cadre of people that are studying how to talk to the terrorists in a situation where they're holding hostages. We don't seem to spend much time in that. I think because the notion is that because they're terrorists, we're just going to go in as soon as we can and kill them. And we don't think about how we might better interact with them to try to prevent the violence. For example, if there was a hijacked plane in the Chicago O'Hare tonight, full of terrorists holding a lot of passengers, the FBI would negotiate with them. The plane would be surrounded, and of course there would be preparations for tactical intervention of the aircraft, but there would also be negotiators trying to resolve it by time to gain more intelligence, to release hostages, and to do a number of things that might help benefit the government's effort. And I'm not sure that we practice those things anywhere to the degree we should compared to the other stuff, if that makes sense to you.
It does, and it's sort of reminiscent of what you're talking going back to the 70s when embracing negotiations started, that there were a number of people in command at the time who maybe didn't recognize the critical value of this, and that's true today. The other thing with regard to terrorism, though, is we often think about it not so much as a hostage situation, but as an after-the-fact situation, like the terrorists came in and blew up this or that or whatever, kind of dealing with it from the aftermath. And with that in mind, I don't know, other than trying to infiltrate and second guess, it's not like you can prophylactically stop these things, but I'm sure that the FBI is somewhat heavily focused on that.
Well, I hope so, and I'm sure there are. You know, when I was a young FBI agent, I was working in South Carolina, and even in the mid-70s, at least at that time, despite the current resurgence, the Ku Klux Klan was pretty much wiped out. And the reason was the FBI had so thoroughly infiltrated it that you would have 20 guys meet for a Ku Klux Klan meeting and 18 of them were FBI informants. So we knew exactly what they were doing and thinking, and eventually that broke the back of the organization. It was probably an unheralded and incredible job that the FBI did. You know, now that it's more difficult with obviously terrorism because of ethnic groups involved, and you can't just slip some middle-aged white-haired guy like me into a group like that and pretend to be accepted. But that's what they're aiming to do, is to prevent these things, and that's proper and appropriate, and it's a challenging task. But my concern is more focused on those, as mentioned, rare instances where they may be holding hostages. And you take the Mumbai situation where they took over the hotel, And yes, it was a terrorist attack, but at some point in time that evolved into hostage taking in the hotel. And the Indian authorities wanted to have absolutely no training or capability in negotiations. And that might have greatly contributed to, you know, maybe getting more hostages out alive or even getting these guys to surrender. And it's just something with regards to terrorism we don't think of, because we think negotiating with terrorism means being weak and capitulating. And that's not what it means at all. You know, what did John Kennedy say? You know, we should never negotiate from fear, but we should never fear to negotiate. It's a strategic tool for us, and we need to use it that way.
Yeah, it's clearly an emotional mindset that can be mined. And even with regard to warfare, traditionally we think of warfare as armies, not bands of terrorists. But when it is more on that level, there's an emotional component. And if that can be capitalized upon, there's probably greater success. Now, I know you wanted to be in the FBI from the time you were a kid outside of Jacksonville. And you certainly got your wish. Looking back on it, I'm sure you had many expectations of what it was going to be like to be a G-man, but what was the biggest surprise in your career working for the FBI?
This will sound like a cop-out, but there's just far too many. I mean, my career was so interesting. I had the opportunity to do so many amazing things, but I have to say in total, when I became a brand new agent in the negotiation field was just emerging, and I heard about it, and it immediately triggered something in me that I found attractive in trying to use communication skills to resolve conflict. So not only doing that throughout my career and teaching it to literally thousands of police officers in the States and abroad, and knowing the impact that's had on saving lives is, you know, it's pretty heady stuff. And, you know, you get these testaments from people, thank you for what you did and what you taught us, and here's how it's made a difference. And, you know, that's pretty rewarding stuff in and of itself. And you know, I didn't just teach it because it was my job. I really believed in that. And you know, and part of it is even the tough old SWAT guys, you know, if I'm successful as a negotiator, that means they don't have to go in and put their lives on the line and maybe get killed and not go home to their families at night. So selfishly, we do it, you know, for that reason more than anything else. It's nice when the hostages come out alive. We celebrate that. And even if the perpetrator surrenders. But the most important thing is that all law enforcement go home every night. And so maybe not a good answer for you, but I kind of look at that as in composite. You know, it's,
right.
You mentioned the first chapter of my book. When I was reunited with Cheryl and her young son after I had lured her former common law husband out and the FBI sniper killed him, you know, she ran up to me crying and threw her arms around me. And I was so choked up, I couldn't speak for half an hour, you know. And you know, we're not without our emotion. And, you know, stuff like that is powerful, and it changes your life in a lot of ways. And, yeah, so I've been rewarded so many times for, you know, having the blind luck as say, gee, this is a job. So, and it was.
Yeah, the letter you reprinted from Cheryl in your book was absolutely touching, and it's one of those things that makes so much of this worthwhile. I wish we had more time, because as we enter into what we've been seeing the last several months, and as sentiments by large blocks of the population are turning against law enforcement, we've got some heady questions coming our way, so I hope there's another book from you coming out soon.
Well, I don't know, but it is interesting that the many interviews I've done in the last several weeks since the Waco special came out on Netflix a few months ago, you know, I try to tell people, you know, the world is not black and white, it's gray. And most cops are great, hardworking, dedicated professionals, but there's a few bad cops. And most people who are protesting have a legitimate grievance, and, you know, they're not looters and arsonists and anarchists. So let's not call names and lump people into groups defined by the worst extremes of whatever side of the equation they're on. We need to open dialogue and talk to people and listen to them and be respectful. By listening, we're neither agreeing or disagreeing. We're just demonstrating you're worthy of my respect, and I hope that you will respect me in turn for listening to you. And that's really a place we've sort of drifted away from in this country now, particularly in politics, and I hope we can find that again.
What a great way to punctuate stalling for time. My life as an FBI hostage negotiator. Gary Nestner, thanks for joining us.
That was my great pleasure.